From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Judge Alito is a conservative activist devoted to rolling back the protections that Congress has provided us all.
President Bush is nominating conservative appeals court Judge Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1991, Judge Alito wrote the lone dissent in a case striking down a Pennsylvania law that included a provision requiring women seeking abortions to inform their husbands. Then we'll take a look at the indictment of Louis Scooter Libby in the CIA leak case. We'll speak with former CIA agent Larry Johnson. And the body of civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks lies in honor in the Capitol Rotunda. She is the first woman and second African-American to lie in state. We'll take a look at her life and go back to 1956 to air a rare interview with Parks, which aired on Pacifica Radio's KPFA.
I felt that I was not being treated right and that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus. The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is nominating federal appeals judge Samuel Alito Jr. to the Supreme Court. Alito's nomination comes just 4 days after Harriet Myers withdrew her nomination. The 55-year-old Alito is widely seen as a judicial conservative who's been nicknamed Scalito for his philosophical similarities to Justice Antonin Scalia. The Christian right has been lobbying Bush to pick a candidate who will oppose abortion rights and overturn Roe v. Wade. In Alito, Bush has picked a judge who has been involved in one of the most significant abortion cases in recent years. As a federal appellate judge, Alito backed a Pennsylvania law that required women to inform their husbands before they sought an abortion. His support came in the form of a dissenting vote in the landmark case Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which eventually went to the Supreme Court in 1992. The high court voted 6-3 to strike down the spousal notification requirement. Last night, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said Alito is not one of the names of acceptable nominees he gave to the president. Reid said of Alito's nomination, quote, "I think it would create a lot of problems." For the first time in 130 years, a White House staff member has been indicted for crimes committed in the office. On Friday, Louis Scooter Libby was indicted on 5 counts of obstruction of justice, perjury to a grand jury, and making false statements to FBI agents during the CIA leak investigation. If convicted, he faces up to 30 years in prison and $1.25 million in fines. Until Friday, Libby was a central figure in the Bush White House, holding 3 top positions, chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, National Security Advisor to the Vice President and Assistant to the President. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald announced the indictment on Friday.
I also want to take away from the notion that somehow we should take an obstruction charge less seriously than a leak charge. This is a very serious matter, and compromising national security information is a very serious matter. But the need to get to the bottom of what happened and whether national security was compromised by inadvertence, by recklessness, by maliciousness, is extremely important. And we need to know the truth. And anyone who would go into a grand jury and lie, obstruct, and impede the investigation has committed a serious crime.
That was Patrick Fitzgerald in his news conference on Friday. President Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove, has so far escaped indictment for his role in the outing of the CIA operative Valerie Plame, the wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson. But Rove remains under investigation. On Sunday, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid called on the president to apologize and for Rove to resign.
He should apologize. The vice president should apologize. They should come clean with the American public. I think Karl Rove should step down. Here is a man who the president said if he was involved, if anyone in the administration was involved, out they would go. And this was confirmed by the press secretary, McClellan, said, "I speak for the president. Anybody's involved in this, they're gone."
Senate Minority Leader Reid was speaking on ABC's This Week. Bush and Cheney have both praised Libby for his service. The top candidate to replace Libby is David Addington, who currently works as the vice president's legal counsel. 3 years ago, he wrote a memo that asserted the war on terrorism renders obsolete the Geneva Convention's limitations of questioning detainees. Ambassador Wilson accused Libby and the White House of outing his wife, Valerie Plame. He said, quote, senior administration officials used the power of the White House to make our lives hell for the last 27 months. But more important, they did it as part of a clear effort to cover up the lies and disinformation used to justify the invasion of Iraq. That is the ultimate crime, Ambassador Wilson said. New polls just out show the public trust in the Bush administration has reached a new low. A new ABC News Washington Post poll has found Bush's approval rating to be just 39%, the lowest of his presidency. Meanwhile, 46% of the country says the level of honesty and ethics in the government has declined under Bush. Only 15% of the country feel Bush has restored honesty and ethics to the government. This comes after what Time magazine described as the worst week of Bush's presidency. Within a span of 4 days, the U.S. death toll in Iraq topped 2,000. Harriet Myers withdrew her nomination to the Supreme Court, and Lewis Schuler Libby was indicted and resigned. Time described it as Bush's, quote, week from hell. In Washington, over 10,000 people began lining up Sunday outside the Capitol to pay homage to civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks. She died last week at the age of 92. Parks' body is lying in honor at the U.S. Capitol in the Rotunda. According to Senate historian Richard Baker, Parks is the first private citizen to ever be accorded the honor. She's also the first woman and the second African-American to lie in honor at the Capitol. The tribute is usually reserved for heads of state. President Reagan was the last person to lie in state at the Capitol. A memorial service will be held today at the Metropolitan AME Church in Washington. Rosa Parks' body will then be flown to Detroit for a funeral on Wednesday. On Sunday, a memorial service was also held in Montgomery, Alabama. We'll have more on Rosa Parks later in the program. In Iraq, the Pentagon has announced the U.S. now has more troops in Iraq than at any time during the invasion or occupation. The total number of troops has now topped 161,000. At least 8 U.S. troops have died since Thursday, bringing the total to 2,015. Meanwhile, attacks on Sunday killed the brother of one of Iraq's two vice presidents and wounded a deputy minister. This comes as the Arab League increased its calls for U.S. troops to leave Iraq. In an interview, Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa said, quote, the end of foreign occupation is one of the prerequisites if we're to witness any progress in our efforts to help Iraq go forward. He went on to say, quote, it's not a taboo. We cannot talk about the future of Iraq without discussing the foreign presence and the end of the occupation. Meanwhile, Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is now claiming he tried to convince President Bush not to invade Iraq.
I have never been convinced that war was the best system to make a country democratic and help it escape dictatorship, even a bloody one. I tried many times to convince the American president not to go to war.
Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. In India, at least 62 people died this weekend in the Indian capital of New Delhi in a string of bombings on Saturday that targeted three crowded market areas. Over 200 people were injured. At least 89 remain hospitalized. The attacks came during the Hindu festival of Diwali. Police in Delhi are now staging one of its biggest manhunts ever in the nation's capital. A little-known Islamic group has claimed responsibility for the attack.
December 1st, 1955, our freedom movement came alive. And because of Sister Rose, you know, we don't ride on the back of the bus no more. Sister Rose, she was tired one day after a hard day on her job, when all she wanted was a well-deserved rest, not a scene from an angry mob. A bus driver said, baby, you got to get up, cause a white person wants that seat. But Miss Rose, she said, no, not no more. I'm gonna stay right here and rest my feet. Yeah, thank you, Miss Rosa. You are the spark that started our freedom movement. Thank you, Sister Rosa Parks.
fail and took Sister Rosa off to jail. And $14 was her fine. Brother Martin Luther King knew it was our time. The people of Montgomery sit down to talk. It was decided all God's children should walk until segregation was brought to its knees and we obtained freedom and equality. Yeah.
Thank you, Miss Rosa. You are the spark that started our freedom movement. Thank you, Sister Rosa Parks.
The Neville Brothers singing Sister Rosa, and we'll talk about Rosa Parks later in the program as she lies in honor in the Capitol Rotunda, the first woman ever to be honored in this way. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has nominated Appeals Court Judge Samuel Alito for the U.S. Supreme Court. Alito is a former U.S. attorney who has been a judge for 15 years. He's considered a favorite of the conservative movement. He'll replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the bench, if confirmed. Bush made the announcement at 8 o'clock this morning, and we're going to play that announcement in just a minute. But the choice of Alito comes after Bush's first pick, Harriet Myers, withdrew her nomination Thursday after coming under intense criticism from the Christian right and many Republican senators who questioned her qualifications and record. Unlike Myers, who's never been a judge, Alito has been a strong conservative voice on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia since former President George H.W. Bush seated him there in 1990. He's been dubbed Scalito or Scalia-lite by some lawyers because his conservative judicial philosophy invites comparisons to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. In 1991, Alito wrote the lone dissenting opinion in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, a case striking down a Pennsylvania law that imposes numerous restrictions on women seeking abortions. The law, among other things, required physicians to advise women of the potential medical dangers of abortion and tell them of the alternatives available. It also imposed a 24-hour waiting period for abortions and barred minors from obtaining abortions without parental consent. In that same ruling, the panel struck down a single provision in the law requiring women to notify their husbands before they obtained an abortion. Alito dissented from that part of the decision. He wrote, quote, "The Pennsylvania legislature could have rationally believed that some married women are initially inclined to obtain an abortion without their husband's knowledge because of perceived problems, such as economic constraints, future plans, or husband's previously expressed opposition. That may be obviated by discussion prior to abortion," he wrote. The case ultimately reached the Supreme Court, which upheld the appeals court decision, disagreed with Alito, and also used the case to reaffirm its support for Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision legalizing abortion. Alito has also been criticized by women's rights organizations for his 1996 dissent in a sex discrimination case, Sheridan v. DuPont. In that case, he argued that Third Circuit had made it too easy for discrimination complaints to reach a jury trial. Alito has been consistently supportive of conservative views in cases involving issues of church and state. He wrote a majority opinion in ACLU versus Schindler, holding that a city's holiday display that included a creche and menorah did not violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Last night, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said Alito, quote, "is not one of the names I've suggested to the president. In fact, I've done the opposite. I think it would create a lot of problems," Reid said. We're joined right now by Seth Rosenthal, legal director of the Alliance for Justice, and in our New York studio by Donna Lieberman. She's executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Donna, I want to begin with you on this case. We'll begin with Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Well, Planned Parenthood versus Casey was a watershed for reproductive rights. On the one hand, it reaffirmed the essential holding of Roe versus Wade, protecting women's right to choose as a matter of privacy, but it nonetheless sustained some limits on women's access to abortion, like waiting periods and what we call biased counseling mandates. But the court unequivocally rejected the mandate in the law for spousal consent before a woman could get an abortion, and Judge Alito had previously sustained that. That is so out of the mainstream of jurisprudence as to really put women's right to choose in jeopardy. And I think that
explain how it's out of the mainstream.
Well. If a woman, one of the core points about the protection of the right to choose is that the decision about having an abortion is a decision about a woman's health. It's about her future. It's about the responsibilities that she's going to have forever and ever and ever. And if you can't make a decision about what happens to your body without your husband's permission, well, then do you have equal rights as a member of our society? And Justice Alito would say no. So I think that we see right, if in fact he's confirmed, there will be four votes to overturn Roe versus Wade. Now, I have to say that the Civil Liberties Union will not normally take a position. We will research his opinions. We will research his records, in the whole array of cases, and raise issues that have to be addressed by the Senate in reviewing his qualifications. But this isn't about whether somebody's a nice guy. This isn't about whether he has a good sense of humor. It isn't whether he's smart or well-prepared only. Those are important. But it's about whether, in fact, Americans are going to enjoy government constitutional protection for fundamental rights as we have thought we could for years and years.
Seth Rosenthal of the Alliance for Justice, your response to this specifically and overall, Judge Alito's record.
Well, you know, the response, I guess, more generally is that, you know, the right wing was howling over the nomination of Harriet Myers because they didn't think that she sort of had the ideological purity that they were demanding. She wasn't a proven movement conservative. Of course, she may have turned out that way, but she didn't have a record showing that she was. And so they were disappointed with the nomination, and they torpedoed it. Now, I mean, you go to the blogs, and they're absolutely giddy about the nomination of Samuel Alito, and that's precisely because he has a record showing that he is a movement conservative, somebody who will move the court definitively to the right, particularly given that he's replacing Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who has been a pivotal swing vote on a number of issues, as conservative as she is. And one of the things, I guess, you know, abortion is obviously a key issue, and it's an issue that's probably, you know, at the forefront of everyone's mind. But if you look at Judge Alito's record in its entirety, I mean, he sort of marches along to the conservative drumbeat on just about every single issue. And two issues, I guess, that I'd like to bring to your listenership's attention are, one, Congress's authority to pass individual protections for all of us, which has been under assault for the last decade. Congress passes laws, a number of laws, under what's called its Commerce Clause power. Its Commerce Clause power has given rise to worker protections, you know, like the minimum wage and maximum hour laws, and occupational safety and health laws. Has allowed Congress to prohibit pollution by passing the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. Has allowed Congress to prohibit discrimination, not just on the basis of race, but on the basis of age, disability, and gender. All of these things, and all of these things could be thrown into jeopardy if the Supreme Court starts to draw back on what it has previously said Congress can do under its Commerce Clause authority. And Judge Alito dissented in a case in 1996 that raises some real concerns. He said that Congress did not have the authority under its Commerce Clause, did not have the authority under its Commerce Clause powers to prohibit the possession of machine guns. That was a dissent, and the majority accused him of, quote, of requiring Congress and the president, the elected branches of government, to, quote, play show and tell with the federal courts. For conservatives who have long complained about judicial activism and who talk about judicial restraint, Judge Alito's record betrays anything but restraint. Here's a guy who, in the words of Jeff Rosen, a legal commentator who actually strongly supported the nomination of John Roberts, he says that that Judge Alito's record displays a troubling lack of respect for Congress. So that's one area. Another area which is very important to the Bush administration is executive power. Obviously, it's been pursuing its war on terror, and it's tried to come up with a number of limitations on the rights of people it has detained in connection with the war on terror. And Judge Alito, former U.S. attorney, former federal U.S. attorney for the District of New Jersey, has sort of gone overboard in giving at least the police the authority to conduct intrusive searches on people who aren't even the subject of arrest warrants. Two decisions he dissented on those grounds. And in one of those decisions, current Department of Homeland Security head Michael Chertoff, who was also on the Third Circuit at the time, strongly criticized Judge Alito's approach as being a rubber stamp approach to police misconduct. So, you know, those are two additional areas over and above abortion that I think people need to start paying attention to.
Well, we are talking to Seth Rosenthal of Alliance for Justice, Donna Lieberman, New York Civil Liberties Union. When we come back from our break, we'll hear President Bush make the nomination of Judge Alito to be Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. After that, we'll talk about the resignation of Scooter Libby. And finally, Rosa Parks lies in honor in the Capitol Rotunda. We'll speak with a Pulitzer Prize-winning author about this civil rights pioneer. Stay with us.
It's a mighty hard road my poor hands have pulled. My poor feet have traveled this hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we roll, through deserts so hot and through mountains so cold. I've wandered all over your green growing land, wherever your crops are, I'll lend you my hands. On the edge of your cities, you see me and then I come with the dust and I'm gone. With a wind, California, Arizona.
Odetta singing Pastures of Plenty here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to President Bush nominating Justice Samuel Alito today for U.S. Supreme Court.
Early in his career, Samuel Alito worked as a federal prosecutor and handled criminal and civil matters for the United States. As assistant to the Solicitor General, he argued 12 cases before the Supreme Court and has argued dozens of others before the Federal Courts of Appeals. He served in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, providing constitutional advice for the President and the executive branch. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan named him the United States Attorney for the District of New Jersey, the top prosecutor in one of the nation's largest federal districts. And he was confirmed by unanimous consent by the Senate. He moved aggressively against white-collar and environmental crimes and drug trafficking and organized crime and violation of civil rights. In his role, Sam Alito showed a passionate commitment to the rule of law. And he gained a reputation for being both tough and fair. In 1990, President Bush nominated Sam Alito at the age of 39 for the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Judge Alito's nomination received bipartisan support, and he was again confirmed by unanimous consent by the United States Senate. Judge Alito has served with distinction on that court for 15 years and now has more prior judicial experience than any Supreme Court nominee in more than 70 years. Judge Alito's reputation has only grown over the span of his service. He has participated in thousands of appeals and authored hundreds of opinions. This record reveals a thoughtful judge who considers the legal merits carefully and applies the law in a principled fashion. He has a deep understanding of the proper role of judges in our society. He understands that judges are to interpret the laws, not to impose their preferences or priorities on the people. In the performance of his duties, Judge Alito has gained the respect of his colleagues and attorneys for his brilliance and decency. He's won admirers across the political spectrum. I'm confident that the United States Senate will be impressed by Judge Alito's distinguished record, his measured judicial temperament, and his tremendous personal integrity. And I urge the Senate to act promptly on this important nomination so that an up or down vote is held before the end of this year.
That is President Bush nominating Samuel Alito to be the next U.S. Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Judge Alito was there with his family to accept the nomination. Of course, the Congress has yet to say, the Senate Judiciary Committee, when they will hold hearings in the confirmation process. We turn now to Judge Alito accepting President Bush's nomination.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I am deeply honored to be nominated to serve on the Supreme Court, and I am very grateful for the confidence that you have shown in me. The Supreme Court is an institution that I have long held in reverence. During my 29 years as a public servant, I've had the opportunity to view the Supreme Court from a variety of perspectives. As an attorney in the Solicitor General's office, arguing and briefing cases before the Supreme Court, as a federal prosecutor, and most recently for the last 15 years as a judge of the Court of Appeals. During all of that time, my appreciation of the vital role that the Supreme Court plays in our constitutional system has greatly deepened. I argued my first case before the Supreme Court in 1982, and I still vividly recall that day. I remember the sense of awe that I felt when I stepped up to the lectern. And I also remember the relief that I felt when Justice O'Connor, sensing, I think, that I was a rookie, made sure that the first question that I was asked was a kind one. I was grateful to her on that happy occasion, and I am particularly honored to be nominated for her seat. My most recent visit to the Supreme Court building was on a very different and a very sad occasion. It was on the occasion of the funeral of Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And as I approached the Supreme Court building with a group of other federal judges, I was struck by the same sense of awe that I had felt back in 1982, not because of the imposing and beautiful building in which the Supreme Court is housed, but because of what the building and, more importantly, the institutions stand for, our dedication as a free and open society to liberty and opportunity, and, as it says above the entrance to the Supreme Court, equal justice under law. Every time that I have entered the courtroom during the past 15 years, I have been mindful of the solemn responsibility that goes with service as a federal judge. Federal judges have the duty to interpret the Constitution and the laws faithfully and fairly, to protect the constitutional rights of all Americans, and to do these things with care and with restraint, always keeping in mind the limited role that the courts play in our constitutional system. And I pledge that if confirmed, I will do everything within my power to fulfill that responsibility.
Justice Samuel Alito accepting the nomination of President Bush for him to be U.S. Associate Justice, the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, replacing Sandra Day O'Connor. Kay Daly, president of the Conservative Coalition for a Fair Judiciary, said the president has made an excellent choice today, which reflects his commitment to appoint judges in the mold of Scalia and Thomas. Final comment, Seth Rosenthal of Alliance for Justice.
Well, I think that comment probably says it all. Judge Alito has earned the nickname Scalito because of the resemblance that his jurisprudence bears to that of Justice Scalito. And I think Jonathan Turley was actually on Katie Couric's show this morning saying there will be nobody on this court if Judge Alito is confirmed who is to the right of him. And Katie Couric said, well, does that include Justice Scalia? And he said, well, it'll probably be a race to the finish, but one or the other will beat the other by a nose. So that gives you a sense of where he's going to be, and that explains why the right wing's so happy now.
Donna Lieberman of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
This is an appointment that will potentially change the face of American constitutional values for years to come, and it's one that the Senate has to look at very, very carefully. It's not about whether he has a law degree from a good school or whether he's got lots of experience or has written articulate opinions. It's about the values that our country has cherished and must continue to cherish for years to come. The Senate has the obligation to question him carefully and thoroughly to determine whether he is in the mainstream of American rights and values or whether he is on the fringe. Clearly, the president has played to his base here. He's a president under fire who has chosen to do that rather than to nominate somebody who is in the mold of Sandra Day O'Connor, who is more of a consensus builder, and the Senate will have to respond accordingly.
Donna Lieberman of the New York Civil Liberties Union and Seth Rosenthal of the Alliance for Justice, thank you for both being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 380 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, and college stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations. And we're on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are podcasting in video and audio at democracynow.org. As we turn now to the issue that is rocking the White House. For the first time in 130 years, a White House staff member has been indicted for crimes committed in office. On Friday, Louis Libby was indicted on 5 counts of obstruction of justice, perjury to a grand jury, and making false statements to FBI agents during the CIA leak investigation. Libby resigned following the indictments. If convicted, he faces up to 30 years in prison and $1.25 million in fines. According to the indictment, Libby lied to the grand jury when he claimed he learned of the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame from NBC News' Tim Russert in early July. In fact, investigators determined Libby learned of Plame from Vice President Cheney, State Department officials, and a CIA briefer more than a month before. President Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove, has so far escaped indictment for his role in the outing of Valerie Plame, the wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Until Friday, Libby was a central figure in the Bush White House, holding 3 positions, chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, national security advisor to the vice president, and assistant to the president. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald announced the indictment Friday afternoon. According to the Washington Post, Karl Rove narrowly escaped the indictment after providing new information during 11th-hour negotiations with Fitzgerald. But sources told the paper that he could still be charged in the case. We're going to turn now to Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald and play an excerpt of his news conference.
But as important as it is for the grand jury to follow the rules and follow the safeguards to make sure information doesn't get out, it's equally important that the witnesses who come before a grand jury, especially the witnesses who come before a grand jury who may be under investigation, tell the complete truth. It's especially important in the national security area. The laws involving disclosure of classified information in some places are very clear, and in some places they're not so clear. And grand jurors and prosecutors making decisions about who should be charged, whether anyone should be charged, what should be charged, need to make fine distinctions about what people knew, why they knew it, what they exactly said, why they said it, what they were trying to do, what appreciation they had for the information, and whether it was classified at the time. Those fine distinctions are important in determining what to do. That's why it's essential when a witness comes forward and gives their account of how they came across classified information and what they did with it, that it be accurate. Now that brings us to the fall of 2003, when it was clear that Valerie Wilson's cover had been blown, an investigation began. And in October 2003, the FBI interviewed Mr. Libby. Mr. Libby is the Vice President's Chief of Staff. He's also an assistant to the President and assistant to the Vice President for National Security Affairs. The focus of the interview was what was it that he had known about Wilson's wife, Valerie Wilson, what he knew about Ms. Wilson, what he said to people, why he said it, and how he learned it. And to be frank, Mr. Libby gave the FBI a compelling story. What he told the FBI is that essentially he was at the end of a long chain of phone calls. He spoke to a reporter, Tim Russert, and during the conversation, Mr. Russert told him that, hey, do you know that all the reporters know that Mr. Wilson's wife works at the CIA? And he told the FBI that he learned that information as if it were new, and it struck him. So he took this information from Mr. Russert, and later on he passed it on to other reporters, including reporter Matthew Cooper of Time magazine, reporter Judith Miller of the New York Times. And he told the FBI that when he passed the information on July 12th of 2003, 2 days before Mr. Novak's column, that he passed it on understanding that this was information he had gotten from a reporter, that he didn't even know if it was true. And he told the FBI that when he passed the information on to the reporters, he made clear that he did not know if this were true. This was something that all the reporters were saying, and in fact, he just didn't know, and he wanted to be clear of that. Later, Mr. Libby went before the grand jury. On two occasions in March of 2004, he took an oath and he testified. And he essentially said the same thing. He said that, in fact, he had learned from the vice president earlier in June 2003 information about Wilson's wife, but he had forgotten it. Now, when he learned the information from Mr. Russert during this phone call, he learned it as if it were new. And when he passed the information on to reporters Cooper and Miller late in the week, he passed it on thinking it was just information he received from reporters, and that he told the reporters that, in fact, he didn't even know if it were true. He was just passing gossip from one reporter to another at the long end of a chain of phone calls. It would be a compelling story that would lead the FBI to go away if only it were true. It is not true, according to the indictment.
Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald. On Sunday, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid called on Karl Rove to resign. Reid pointed out President Bush had previously said anyone involved in the leak should resign. We're joined on the telephone right now by former CIA analyst Larry Johnson. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hey, how are you doing?
Very good to have you with us. Can you talk about your response to the indictment?
I think it's a good start, a move in the right direction. What's appalling is the response, you know, the Republican response is expected, but mainstream media figures, whether we're talking Tim Russert or Andrea Mitchell or others, who are trying to say, well, so there's no underlying crime, so really no harm, no foul. You know, if you listen very carefully to what Fitzgerald said, her cover was blown. And, you know, when you say his cover was blown, that means she had cover, number one. Number two, the reason he could not indict under the Identities Protection Act is because Libby obstructed the investigation. So, you know, if Fitzgerald is just biding his time. He is going to ultimately come in with an indictment on the original crime. But he's going to squeeze these guys very carefully. So I think we're fortunate to have someone of Fitzgerald's character involved with this.
Larry Johnson, you trained with Valerie Plame?
Yes, we were in the career trainee program together, and that started in September of 1985. From the day we all walked through that door, all of us were undercover. Later, several members of our class moved into what's called non-official cover status, which means they had no known association with the U.S. government in any fashion. And when they worked overseas, they were working under commercial cover or something else. You know, as in Valerie's case, she was an energy consultant for Brewster Jennings.
And when you say non-official cover or commercial cover, explain what you're talking about. Explain the energy front firm that she claimed that she works for as she investigated weapons of mass
destruction. When you work under official cover, you are acknowledged to have to be a U.S. government employee, but you're usually perceived as either a State Department employee or Department of Defense or Department of Energy or some other federal agency. And when you travel overseas, you have a black passport, which is a diplomatic passport. If you are caught in the act of doing espionage, you are protected under that black passport by the Geneva Convention, and you will not be executed. You may spend a few days in jail, but ultimately you'll be released. Valerie, however, traveled without the benefit of a diplomatic passport. She, and in some cases, NOCs or non-official cover officers will travel even with a foreign passport. If she had been caught, she would have no protection under the diplomatic, the Geneva Convention, or no protection as a diplomat, and she could have been executed. So the purpose of using non-official cover companies is there are many people in the world who have information that we want, but getting access to them requires that, in some cases, they don't want to deal with a U.S. government official, so that you use deception. And, you know, this is about lying in part.
Larry Johnson, before the indictment came down, you accused Vice President Cheney, the Bush administration, of engaging in a covert action against the American people. Explain.
Yeah. It has the hallmarks. Covert action is, in the past, the CIA has used it overseas as a way to shape public opinion. Usually, in the experiences I've had, it has been used where we use the truth. In other words, you didn't have to go out and manufacture lies in order to deceive people. You would focus upon, there were efforts to get the vote out in Greece and in other places to get the focus on some communist subversion, to use old-style Cold War language. In this case, when we look back at the case of how the facts were fixed around the intelligence leading up to the war, it is classic covert action. In other words, this government deliberately deceived its own people. And two quick examples, and one of these continues. In the Niger claim that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Niger, the position of the intelligence community was consistently that there was no there. They rejected it. They didn't find it credible. They briefed that on several occasions to Congress and, in fact, told President Bush to take it out of his speech. Yet despite that, the information kept working its way back in. And there is now evidence of contacts between the Italian government dealing with the Office of the Vice President and the National Security Council to get the information from the forged documents into the U.S. government. That despite the fact that the CIA chief of station had repeatedly rebuffed attempts by the Italians to keep feeding them that. On the question of Osama bin Laden and working with Saddam Hussein, the intelligence community, again, consistently has said there was no relationship, there is no substance to that charge. Yet the administration and others in the Office of Special Plans at the Department of Defense repeatedly put that word out to shape public opinion on something that was false. As I again looking at it, has the hallmarks of a covert action effort directed against the American people.
The special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, was quite careful to say that this investigation is not over, though the grand jury has expired.
Correct.
We don't know what will happen with Karl Rove. He remains under investigation. Of course, you've raised questions about Vice President Cheney. What do you think should happen right now?
Well, at a minimum, if Bush was serious about protecting this nation's security, he should turn to Karl Rove and ask for his resignation. His clearances should be pulled because there's no doubt now that he was involved with helping pass the name and mishandle classified information. Whether he was, quote, witting under the law to have a crime that you can convict of is a different matter. But there is absolutely no doubt that he was mishandling classified information. Therefore, he should no longer have access to such information. I think the president could potentially get this behind him, but I doubt if he's going to. And instead of doing what's right, he's just going to continue to protect cronies.
Larry Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us, former CIA analyst, former deputy director of the U.S. State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. Today, the body of Rosa Parks lies in honor in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. She's the first woman, only second African-American, to receive this honor, usually reserved for presidents, soldiers, politicians. Last Monday, Parks died at the age of 92 at her home in Detroit, Michigan. It was 50 years ago this December that Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man aboard a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. She was arrested, convicted of violating the state segregation laws. Her act of resistance led to a 13-month boycott of the Montgomery bus system that would spark the civil rights movement, inspire freedom struggles around the world. The bus boycott would also help transform a 26-year-old preacher named Dr. Martin Luther King to national prominence. This past weekend, thousands were in Montgomery, Alabama for Rosa Parks' memorial service. On Saturday, mourners streamed past her open coffin to pay their last respects. On Sunday, a service was held at the Paul AME Church, where Parks was a member at the time of her arrest. One of the speakers was Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
Her singular act of courage and defiance set off a revolution in this country that eventually made America face up to its birth defect and face up to the hard work that it still had ahead of it. I think I can quite honestly say that without Mrs. Parks, I would probably not be standing here today as Secretary of State.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, this is Reverend Al Sharpton.
We're not there yet. Let's not act like this is some memory of when we had problems. We still have problems. We're still doubly unemployed. We still have a nation that has health care for some and not others. We still have disparity in the criminal justice system. We still have a government that can gear up quicker to go abroad for weapons that are not there than a hurricane down south that is there. We still got work to do. And Ms. Parks, we're committed to continue to work. We will not disgrace the fact that you wouldn't move. Because you wouldn't move, we won't move. And we won't be flattered into forgetting what you did. And we won't be forgetful of what you expect out of us.
That was Reverend Al Sharpton speaking in Montgomery, Alabama, at the memorial service of civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks. Last night, her body was flown to Washington, D.C., where it now lies in honor at the Capitol Rotunda, public viewing taking place last night and today. Thousands of people have lined up to pay last respects. We're going to turn now for just a moment to an excerpt of an interview done with Rosa Parks in April of 1956 by Pacifica Radio. We pull this from the Pacifica Radio archives. Rosa Parks describing her action, December of 1955.
I left work on my way home December 1st, 1955, about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I boarded the bus downtown in Montgomery on Coates Square. As the bus proceeded out of town, on the third stop, the white passengers had filled the front of the bus. When I got on the bus, the rear was filled with colored passengers, and they were beginning to stand. The seat I occupied was the first of the seats where the Negro passengers take as they on this route. The driver noted that the front of the bus was filled with white passengers, and there would be two or three men standing. He looked back and asked that the seat where I had taken, along with three other persons, one in the seat with me and two across the aisle, was seated. He demanded the seat that we were occupying. The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused to do so. I want to make very certain that it is understood that I had not taken a seat in the white section, as has been reported in many cases. An article came out in the newspaper on Friday morning about the Negro woman overlooked segregation. She was seated in the front seat, the white section of the bus, and refused to take a seat in the rear of the bus. That was the first newspaper account. The seat where I occupied, we were in the custom of taking this seat on the way home, even though at times on this same bus route, we occupied the same seat with whites standing if their space had been taken up, the seats had been taken up. I was very much surprised that the driver at this point demanded that I remove myself from the seat. The driver said that if I refused to leave the seat, he would have to call the police, and I told him, just call the police. He then called the officers of the law. They came and placed me under arrest. Violation of the segregation law of the city and state of Alabama and transportation. I didn't think I was violating any. I felt that I was not being treated right, then that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus. The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose. They placed me under arrest.
That is Rosa Parks speaking in April 1956 in the midst of the Montgomery bus boycott. She had refused to stand up for a white passenger just a few months before December 1st, 1955. We're joined in our New York studio by Diane McWhorter, author of Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, and the Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. She won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for this book. We're also joined on the telephone by longtime civil rights activist Reverend Joseph Lowry, co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, involved in the 1950s, even before Rosa Parks refused to stand up in desegregating the South, particularly transportation, and was this weekend in Montgomery, Alabama, for the service, the memorial service for Rosa Parks. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Reverend Lowry, your memory of Rosa Parks in the 1950s, when you would come up from Mobile to Montgomery to support her in the bus boycott?
Well, she was a mild-mannered activist. She was deceptive in her demeanor. You'd never expect her to be as inside, as fiery and courageous as she really was. And so when they called me in Mobile and told me she was the person who sparked the boycott, I was surprised and amused and, of course, delighted. Because she was a wonderful woman who did not act as a soloist. While she was alone on the bus, she was part of a movement. She was active in the NAACP, and long before she refused to give up her seat on the bus, she engaged in voter registration drives, in helping young people understand the struggle. And even after the boycott, she continued to work in the movement. So she was part of an organized effort to change America and to, as a seamstress, not only a seamstress on clothes, but a seamstress on the fabric of American democracy. It needed mending, and she was the person God chose to do it at this moment in history.
Diane McWhorter, you're a white woman who grew up in the 50s and 60s in Birmingham, and you wrote about this whole experience in Carry Me Home. Your response to Rosa Parks, a woman you have met?
You know, I grew up thinking that she was this sweet little simple woman who had spontaneously decided to not get up because her feet were tired. And that's kind of the legend that's come down. As Reverend Lowry just said, that was far from the truth. I think that both she and Dr. King are kind of, you know, there's Dr. King at the Lincoln Memorial and then Rosa Parks on the bus. And that's kind of how the civil rights movement has been passed on in legend. And the great thing about it is that, you know, the more you get into it, the more you realize how thrilling all the various dimensions are. And how, you know, Martin Luther King had said that the zeitgeist had tracked Rosa Parks down. And in fact, her action was sort of the culmination of a whole lot of things that had been going on before that.
You feared your father was a member of the Klan in the 60s.
Right.
What did that mean for you, on the one hand being inspired by Rosa Parks and the other hand living in your family?
Well, I can't say that at the time I was inspired by Rosa Parks, and I was only, 2 years old when she, when she sat down. But I think that, to tell you the truth, the thing that upset me most about my father was that I was afraid that he was going to embarrass my family, that he was going to do something illegal. And I think that my fear of that sort of got me thinking about this in a way that my peers did not. But I can't say that I had any kind of sort of moral conversion because of that at the time. That came later.
What sparked later?
To tell you the truth, it was because I went to college during the counterculture, and then and it would have been very unseemly to carry those attitudes, you know, up to the North to college with me. And it was and I became more of the anti-Vietnam War protest group generation, and then the civil rights consciousness followed that. One thing I always tell people, though, is that the scariest thing about segregation was that, because now we look back on it and we can't believe that that had gone on in this country, but it seemed normal to people who lived under it, and it seemed normal to white people, and it seemed normal to African Americans, which is why Rosa Parks's action was so radical in a way, because people accepted it, and whites and blacks did. So, you know, so that's in a way the scariest thing about the whole thing, that it was normal.
Reverend Lowry, there'll be a memorial service in Washington, D.C. today. You were at the memorial service in Montgomery. We only have a few seconds, but what was it like? Thousands turned out.
Well, it was a great tribute to not only the Rosa Parks, but to the movement. I couldn't hardly hear what the distinguished author was saying, but I thought I heard her say that it was accepted by black people, the patterns, and it may have appeared that way, but black people never were comfortable under segregation, and the fact that Mrs. Parks, an ordinary citizen, an ordinary person, expressed that resentment and that non-acceptance is a part of history. But we were always uncomfortable with segregation because we knew that God did not intend for any of his children to be humiliated, ostracized, or set aside.
Reverend Joseph Lowry, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us, and Diane McWhorter for being with us, author of Carry Me Home. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Shreeford Okadusi, Uber Rich, and Mike Burke, and other producers. DemocracyNow.org, our website. I'm Annie Goodman. Thanks for joining.